Mother Mountain to the left and Grandfather Mountain to the right. Their spirits always there, stoically sheltering her. Angela knew that there had to be a bottom to the hellhole under the basement floor, but everything she'd tried to measure the depth had been unsuccessful. She once bought rolls of string, tied a big bolt to the end of one, and then fed the string down the hole, tying on the end of new rolls when one ran out, until she ran out of rolls. It surprised her that she hadn't hit bottom. In all, the string she had used had been over 500 feet long. The metal bolt at the end of the string had swung around near the top, bouncing off wide walls as it descended, but lower down, it hit nothing. So she knew the abyss wasn't constricted. She was even more surprised when she let the string go and watched the end flutter away down into the darkness. She counted the seconds until it hit bottom. She never heard a sound. As far as Angela knew, it might as well still be falling. When she'd aimed a powerful light down into the hellhole, the light revealed smooth granite walls that sloped inward a bit, then widened again, then got crooked for a bit, and then opened wider yet as they descended until the light simply evaporated in the darkness. Her grandfather had told her to be careful around the hellhole, because if she ever fell in, she would never be seen again. There were no shelves of rock, stone spurs, or roots to grab hold of if you fell in, no corners to wedge a foot, nowhere to get a grip to climb back out. Greasy layers of moss grew in places and covered the flat stone where moisture seeped through fine cracks. It was nothing but basically a slippery, smooth, and somewhat crooked granite shaft down into a great abyss. She knew that her grandfather was right. If you fell in, there was nothing to stop you. No one would ever hear you screaming for help on the way down, and you would not survive the fall. Even if you somehow did, you would never be able to climb out. You would die in the cold blackness. Angela suspected that over the thousands of years before her grandfather had built the cabin, all sorts of animals had probably slipped on the sloping ledge and fallen to their death. She imagined that there were prehistoric predators down at the bottom of the abyss. Sometimes she wondered if there might even be a saber-toothed tiger down there. Angela had once tossed a flare down into the bottomless pit. She watched it fall, until the shrinking dot of flickering reddish light had gradually vanished into nothingness. Another time, she had held several smoking pieces of incense over the hole to see if air was moving up or down through the opening, which would indicate another entrance somewhere down in the hole, a side shaft. But the smoke revealed absolutely no air movement. The hole was not the entrance into a subterranean cave system. It was just a hole. A very deep hole, but just a hole. When her grandfather had shown her the hell hole, she had asked him if Frankie was down in that hole. He said only that men like Frankie belonged in hell. As far as Angela was concerned, that told her everything she needed to know. Frankie was no longer alone in the hell hole. That first man Angela had recognized as a killer had joined him after his 3-day introduction to hell. Other men had followed, all killers she had recognized by what she had seen in their eyes. They were killers who would never again harm anyone. Their remains would never be found. They would be down there forever with the other ancient predators. Owen would have joined them, except that it was more important to Angela that she find out where he had left the body of Carrie Stratton, the last woman he had murdered. Her family needed to know. Owen's corpse would reveal her location. Angela pulled the sheath with the knife out of her boot. She tossed the knife, in its sheath, down the hellhole. She heard it skip against the stone walls a few times on its way down, and then there was nothing but silence as it descended. Next, she sat on the metal chair off to the other side of the basement and removed her boots and socks. She tossed them down the gaping black hole. Next, she shed her shorts, underpants, and top, dropping them down into the darkness. everything she'd had on went down into the abyss. She didn't want to have to worry about some forensic scientist finding blood in a seam of her boots or a speck in the fabric of her shorts or top. Part of the way she kept anyone from finding any evidence was to get rid of it in a way that it would never be found. That included the knife. Owen's blood was all over that knife. For all she knew, there were seams in the knife's construction that held blood evidence. The only way she could be sure the authorities never found any evidence was if they never found any evidence. Simple as that. The only way she could do that and be safe was if everything always went down the hellhole. She never made exceptions. It wasn't worth the risk. From one of the cabinets, Angela retrieved a new knife and a new sheath. It was just like the one she'd used on Owen. There were a dozen and a half more of them, all the same, all razor sharp, lined up in a row in the cabinet. Completely naked, with the new knife, she went back upstairs to shower and get some clothes. She wished the experience of killing Owen could have lasted longer. She would have loved to have given him more of what he deserved. At least he was dead now, and could never hurt anyone again. But already, that glorious, intoxicating high was fading. After she showered and put on some clean clothes, she checked her phone on the nightstand. There was a missed call from hospice. She could have called them back. There was always someone available. Instead, she sent a text. "Sorry, I missed your call. I had to work." She deliberately didn't provide any other information or say when she would have time. She tossed the phone back on the nightstand and retrieved her Walther P-22 and the Gemtech suppressor. Most people called them silencers, but her grandfather had told her that they were suppressors because they suppressed sound. They didn't completely silence it. She pulled out a couple of boxes of subsonic ammunition and loaded 10 magazines. She liked using the suppressor when she practiced, especially at night. Night and fog seemed to carry sound for miles. She didn't like to unnecessarily attract attention, especially attention from gunshots. Gunshots drew sheriff's deputies and game wardens. She'd found that out a long time ago and decided that she didn't want to repeat it. There was nothing illegal about shooting on her own property, but they still had come to investigate the reports of gunfire. Also, when using a suppressor, she didn't need to use hearing protection, which allowed her to be more alert for anything out of the ordinary, like someone sneaking up on her. Suppressors required federal licenses to be legal, the same as fully automatic weapons. She didn't want a machine gun, but she wanted suppressors. And she didn't want to go through the long and arduous process of getting a federal license for them. That process would surely raise suspicions and put a red flag by her name. One good thing about knowing drug dealers and their friends was that they could usually get you just about anything illegal you wanted if you had the cash. Angela had the cash and bought a large number of suppressors, no questions asked. No ID, no background check, no paperwork, no waiting. Even with a suppressor, gunshots emitted a loud crack when the bullet went supersonic. The subsonic rounds avoided the ballistic crack, so with those subsonic rounds and a suppressor, the gun was virtually silent. Most of the sound was the slide cycling as it ejected the spent round and loaded a live one. Even though those subsonic rounds were slower, they were still lethal. A bullet needed to be traveling at only 200 feet per second to penetrate the human skull, providing it hit relatively squarely. If it hit that deadly triangle, it was guaranteed to kill. Outside, Angela wound up her grandfather's triangular target. She practiced nearly every day. She practiced so much that she could just about hit the target with her eyes closed. Practice was also a form of focused violence, which helped extend the high of dispatching Owen. Angela took shooting practice seriously. That very first man she had recognized as a killer opened her eyes to her strange ability. He would have added her to his kill tally when he snuck into her cabin, had she not been such a good shot. Her grandfather had taught her well. She missed her grandparents. Some killer had put a bullet in the back of their heads. Some killer that she knew she could now recognize by looking into his eyes. He had better pray to God that Angela never found out who he was. 19. Jack Raines watched as Ehud worked his way through the people moving along the pedestrian mall near a corner cafe. Police in light blue shirts and dark blue flak jackets watched over everyone as they walked in pairs along the street. Soldiers in the distance kept watch from their posts. Jack paused to wait as Ehud, the Mossad team leader in plain clothes, approached. Ehud stepped back out of the way momentarily for a gaggle of older women in a tour group, chatting and laughing among themselves as they moved up the street, all of them loaded down with bags from recent purchases. They were all in a cheerful mood, giving little thought to any danger that might be among them. That was human nature. It was the job of Jack and those watching with him to think of little else. There were tourists of every variety and speaking a variety of different languages visiting the pedestrian malls in the Jerusalem Triangle. Shops along the stone streets were busy selling artwork, clothes, shoes, religious souvenirs, fresh fruit, housewares, and baked goods. Once the tight knot of tourists had passed, Jack signaled with a tilt of his head for the man to come closer.
"We have everyone in position," Ehud said as he joined Jack. "We're ready to begin again."
Jack nodded.
"I'll get Uziel and start a sweep. Stay close. He's already nervous. I don't want anything spooking him, and I certainly don't want him getting hurt. He's too valuable."
Jack scanned the people all up and down the street. The triangle seemed unusually crowded. Maybe it was just his anxiety playing mind tricks. The plan was to go up Ben Yehuda Street, past the colorful shops, sidewalk cafes, and food stands, where the heaviest concentration of tourists visited. Crowds drew threat. Jack and his team were hunting threats.
"Don't worry. We will keep in constant contact with both of you," Ehud said. "Be ready for my signal if Uziel spots anyone."
Jack watched for anything out of the ordinary as the light rail cars swept by, carrying a whirling rush of sound with them. Once they were past, the sound of shuffling shoes and conversation seeped back into the sunny day. Jack could hear music in the distance, and closer in, some bubbly laughter. In the street beyond, three green buses lined up at the curb to let people out for the triangle area. Squadrons of white taxis prowled the surrounding streets, waiting for fares or to drop people off. Soldiers, police, and men and women in plain clothes watched over everyone, hoping that the visitors had a pleasant, uneventful day in the triangle. Not long ago, Uziel's rare vision had been spot on, and they had captured an assassin before he could do any harm. They didn't know where he was from or what his target had been, but they knew by the way he kept his mouth shut that he was well-trained. Jack thought that it would be quite a while before they got much of anything out of him. It took time with men like that. The Mossad would have to find an angle, a crack they could exploit, to open him up. Jack knew that they would eventually succeed, at least to some extent, but it would take time. For now, what was important was that he was off the streets. With the heavy crowds in the area, the difficulty of identifying threats was increased. The more people there were, the easier it was for a terrorist to hide among them. But that was why they were using Uziel. He could see what none of them ever could.
"Keep your eyes open," Jack said. "I'll go get him."
Ehud melted into the people, perusing the rows of bread on display in a shop window next door. He and his team would be close by at all times. Inside the cafe, Jack saw Uziel standing off to the side, next to a tall wrought iron table where a couple of Americans were talking. The tabletop was only big enough for a few people to rest their drinks. Uziel One forearm resting on the table, idly turned a cup of coffee round and round as his gaze darted about, looking at everyone. He was nervous, and with good reason. Those very rare individuals with his ability to recognize killers were often the targets of rare predators who could recognize them for that ability. Human predators, just like the four-legged kind, didn't like any interference with their hunting. If spotted, the four-legged kind would usually move on and come back to hunt another time. The human predators, on the other hand, sought to eliminate anyone who could recognize them to give themselves free rein to hunt as they pleased. More than that, though, Jack knew that Uziel was tense for another reason. His young wife had recently died of a brain tumor. They had been married for only 2 months when the tumor had been discovered. Her health went downhill rapidly from there. 3 months after the tumor had been discovered, she was dead. Uziel was left dazed by the trauma and feeling lost. That was when Jack discovered him. He had been shopping for dinner and saw Uziel doing the same. Jack couldn't tell if someone was a killer by looking at their eyes, the way Uziel could, but he had the singular ability to recognize those who could. He struck up a conversation with the young man, and eventually Jack filled a void in Uziel's life, giving him a purpose. To an extent, Jack understood Uziel's pain. A woman he had once been fond of had that same special ability as Uziel. Jack had tried to convince her of the danger she was in, but she wanted nothing to do with Jack's help. At least, not until it was too late. One of those predators had recognized her for her ability and murdered her. That experience had made him realize that in his calling he couldn't afford the risk of emotional entanglement. But that was before he had met Kate. Kate was different. She had, of course, been confused and skeptical at first, but she quickly came to grasp everything Jack had told her. He had helped teach her how to survive. Together, they worked to stop a highly unusual nest of predators bent on hunting and killing those with her ability. Over time, Kate had come to mean more to him than he thought anyone ever could. Every line of her face, her mannerisms, the sound of her voice, were now stitched into his soul. Her ability far outstripped that of anyone he had ever found before. Not only was she able to recognize killers, but she had vague visions of what those killers had done. This was the ultimate type of person Jack searched for. From years of research, he was sure they had to exist, but Kate was the only one he'd ever found with that higher level ability. Unfortunately, in a battle with that nest of murderers, Jack had been gravely wounded. He had died for a time, even as a team of Mossad combat medics worked on him. No one thought he would make it. He didn't remember anything after that hail of bullets, except the fading vision of Kate's horror-stricken face. That memory still haunted him. He never regained consciousness before being flown to Israel to see if there was anything the doctors there could do to keep him alive. To save Kate the trauma of what they believed would be his inevitable death, and at best a vegetative state even if they were able to save his life, they told her that he had died. Everyone thought it best. After he'd eventually come out of the coma, Jack had spent 7 months in the hospital recovering from his injuries, and then there were more months of physical therapy. By the time he had been aware enough to do anything, Kate had vanished. She was highly intelligent, as those at her level of ability were. She had come to understand both what her ability meant and the danger it put her in. She had done what Jack had taught her to do, what he'd told her she would need to do. She had gone off the grid and disappeared. Not even his friends in the Mossad could locate her. For people like Kate, who could recognize killers, the safest thing to do was to be invisible. Their kind were always hunted by rare super predators. Since the ability ran in families, That kind of killer often murdered the entire family to make sure that none with the ability survived. Jack circled an arm around Uziel's shoulders.
How are you doing?
Uziel forced a smile.
I'm fine.
He didn't look fine. He chewed gum with his mouth open as if his life depended on it, while his gaze darted around at the people outside on the street.
Let's not draw attention, all right?
Jack put a finger under the young man's chin to close his mouth. Uziel smiled self-consciously and spit the gum into his empty coffee cup.
How about we get going? Jack said. You did good before, spotting that last killer.
Just remember what I told you. Don't fixate. Scan and take in as many different pairs of eyes as you can. Uziel swiped a lock of straight brown hair back off his forehead. He leaned a little closer.
I'm fine, Jack. Really?
He let out a deep breath to calm himself.
I want to do this. I want to stop anyone else from losing a loved one.
Jack pressed his earpiece, listening to his team calling out their location, before leading Uziel out of the cafe. The streets in this area of Jerusalem, known as the Triangle, had long been closed to automobile traffic and turned into an open-air pedestrian mall. It was a beautiful area, with trees and planters down the center of some of the streets, and a wide variety of shopping along with a vibrant nightlife. The nightlife also drew crowds, which were also a target for terrorists. But with Uziel's talent, it was easier to spot killers in the daytime. Uziel needed to be able to see their eyes. Darkness provided cover. Of course, so did sunglasses. 20. Jack kept Uziel moving at a leisurely pace. They paused at shops along the way to give him a chance to scan the crowds. It also helped the two of them to look like nothing more than a couple of tourists or shoppers. He didn't want to look obvious to any potential threat seeking an easy terrorist target. They made their way through some of the narrow, connecting streets, packed tightly with vendors or shops, with their wares on display outside. Uziel occasionally glanced at the racks with hanging scarves, necklaces, and rosaries, or tables of fruits, pastries, and tourist trinkets, trying to look like an ordinary shopper as he watched the faces that continually streamed past him, going in the opposite direction. Uziel suddenly stiffened to a stop.
What?
Jack asked, looking up.
Faded green t-shirt,
Uziel said, with a nod of his head, indicating someone across the street. Jack looked over and saw the older, heavy-set man in the faded t-shirt. The faded t-shirt had what looked like a lifetime of stains. The man's heavy jowls and hanging double chins were unshaven. He looked to be in a daze. Jack just couldn't picture the guy as a murderer, but then, he didn't have Uziel's ability, and murderers were often quite unremarkable-looking.
Heavy, older man, faded green shirt, walking past the Jamin jewelry store, he said into the microphone under the collar of his shirt.
Two men in plain clothes emerged from the crowds, each grabbing an arm of the older man, bringing him to a halt. Two police officers immediately swept in and took over. The man twisted his head around, looking at the two policemen as he protested in Hebrew. He was still protesting as he was rushed away. People in the nearby crowd stared at the apprehension. All the people in Jack's team melted back into the crowds as people watched the police taking the man away. The whiff of danger in the air was palpable as people switched from a fun day to murmuring about the possibility of danger. It became clear rather quickly that it was a criminal arrest and not a threat of terrorism. Within a few minutes of the man being taken away to jail, people returned to enjoying their day out. They would have a story for the dinner table. Uziel and Jack returned to their reason for being in the Triangle and were soon back to searching the crowds for trouble. With the sun high in the sky, it was becoming a hot day. Uziel and Jack stopped at a shop to buy a couple of bottles of water. For a time, they sat on a bench, drinking water, engaged in the very ordinary act of people-watching. Except their form of people-watching was quite out of the ordinary. In the early afternoon, Ehud came on over the radio.
"The man we arrested is a murderer," he said into Jack's earpiece. "The police have been looking for him. He murdered his wife last night. Apparently, he has been wandering the streets since then."
"Okay. Thanks," Jack said quietly toward the microphone. "Well," he told Uziel,
"you were right. The guy you pointed out killed his wife."
Uziel shook his head as he took in the news.
"Doesn't seem fair."
Jack frowned.
"Fair?"
Uziel tossed his empty water bottle in a trash can.
"To have a wife you love taken from you, while someone else, blessed with life, doesn't appreciate what they have."
"I see what you mean," Jack said. "Anyway, the guy wasn't the kind of threat we're hunting, so let's get back to it."
They walked on down the street, to an area overlooking a plaza of sorts, where several streets intersected. The area was filled with people going in all directions. They slowed as Uziel gazed out over the crowds below them. As they stood in the river of people slowly drifting up the street, they suddenly heard screaming. It was a soldier, pointing as he yelled, "Bomb! Bomb! Bomb!" Soldiers suddenly ran in from every direction, guns at the ready. They screamed orders for people to get back. Jack stretched up to see over the heads of the crowd. He saw a man in the street, not too far away, shirt thrown open, frantically jabbing a finger at what was clearly a bomb vest, trying to detonate it. The word bomb had flashed through the crowd like wildfire. Almost instantly, all the people in the streets started stampeding. What had been a quiet shopping afternoon turned into loud, screaming panic. All at once, thousands of people began to flee the danger. Uziel and Jack, standing at the end of a table in front of a shop that sold sunglasses, were sheltered from the crush of people racing past them, trying to escape the danger. The mood of the shoppers had instantly switched from convivial shopping to mass hysteria. Through gaps in the mob of people bolting past, Jack saw two soldiers dive in and grab the suicide bomber by his arms. They took him to the ground while preventing him from detonating his bomb. More soldiers rushed in to help. Jack stepped behind Uziel, getting ready to shepherd him into the flood of people rushing past to get him away from the danger. Jack just caught a glimpse of a cowboy hat beyond Uziel abruptly pause. Uziel gasped in recognition. Jack flicked open the blade of the knife in his right hand as he swept his left arm around Uziel's waist to pull him back. In the next instant, as Jack was beginning to yank Uziel back away from danger, the man slammed a knife into the center of Uziel's chest so hard it toppled Uziel back on top of Jack. In that fleeting instant, Jack saw the back of the killer disappearing into the mad dash of panicked people. All Jack could tell was that the man had short black hair and a beard. He never saw the attacker's face. Before Uziel and Jack both hit the ground, the assassin was already gone. Jack caught sight of the cowboy hat on the ground, being trampled by the stampede of panicked people.
"Medic!"
Jack yelled into the microphone. "We need a medic!" In the mad scene, three of his team in plain clothes were already there, protecting Uziel down on the ground. When Jack saw the wound in the center of Uziel's chest and the amount of blood, he knew that the young man was beyond help. Two army medics rushed up, going to a knee on either side of Uziel, but Jack knew it was no use. The assassin had only needed to strike once. Jack knew that Uziel's heart had been torn apart by that knife. Uziel had been dead before he hit the ground. Jack wanted to scream in rage. He wanted to get the man who had been wearing the cowboy hat, but he was long gone. Jack knew he wouldn't even be able to recognize him. He had barely caught a glimpse of the hat and a beard. Uziel, though, had recognized the man as a killer, if only an instant before the man had murdered him. The assassin had obviously recognized Uziel for his rare ability. Jack wanted to tell Uziel how sorry he was that he hadn't protected him. He had promised that he would do his best to keep Uziel out of danger. He gritted his teeth in rage at himself for failing to stop the attack. The medics had not given up, but Jack had seen enough killings to know that the man was beyond help. There was a lot of blood, but it was no longer spurting from the gaping wound. That was because the heart was too damaged to continue pumping. Ehud rushed up, breathless. He stopped in his tracks when he saw Uziel on the ground in a spreading pool of blood, medics to either side. One started an IV as the other was doing CPR.
"What happened?" Ehud asked. "That suicide bomber was meant to be a diversion," Jack said. "The real target was Uziel." "How do you know?" "As soon as someone yelled bomb, the crowd started running. The killer was apparently in that crowd, using it as cover. He recognized Uziel for his ability before Uziel saw him. When he did, it was too late. I wish I would have gotten a look at his face, but I only caught a glimpse of a cowboy hat. I was under Uziel's dead weight as he went down and tried to snatch a quick look, but the killer had vanished into the panicked crowd. I never got a look at his face."
Ehud ran his fingers back through his wavy hair as he looked around, clearly frustrated and angered at the same time. One of the plainclothes members of the team rushed in close.
"We got the bomber before he could detonate his bomb vest," he said to Ehud.
Of course, they knew that, because there was no explosion. People still rushing away from the scene gave a wide berth to the dead man in the pool of blood and the soldiers around him. Police officers had appeared and were already pushing the crowds back. Jack stayed with Uziel as the medics worked on him. He could hear an ambulance in the distance. He felt useless. He felt sick. These people had saved Jack's life when he had been shot and was, for all practical purposes, dead. But he knew that Uziel's wound was different. He was beyond the same kind of help. The assassin had known what he was doing, and he had not failed. Jack stood back when the ambulance arrived, letting the medical people do their job. Once Uziel was on a gurney and loaded into the ambulance, Jack turned to Ehud.
"I'm going with him."
He could tell that Ehud wanted to object, but in the end, he only nodded.
"It's not your fault, Jack."
"I'm the one who recognized his ability," Jack said as he hopped up into the ambulance.
"I recruited him."
It was a somber ride to the hospital in the wailing ambulance. Jack thought that he must have once looked as hopeless as Uziel did now, when he had been the one riding in an ambulance. He wished that Uziel could have the same chance at life that had been given to Jack by the Israeli doctors. He held on to a thread of hope, even though he knew better. When they raced into the ambulance bay at the hospital, there was already a team of doctors and nurses waiting. Uziel's lifeless body was rolled in through double doors, surrounded by a medical team running beside the gurney. Jack hoped against hope they could perform a miracle, the same as they had done for him. He waited all alone on a bench in a hallway, wishing he had never found Uziel. Wishing he had never told him that he might be able to save lives. Uziel had wanted to do it, though. Jack wished he had said no and left Uziel to live his life. But finding those rare people with Uziel's vision was Jack's calling in life. It was what he could do that none other could. It was late that night when the doctor came out to see Jack. As he expected, there was no saving the young man. Jack nodded and thanked the doctor. With no sense of urgency, the doctor went back in through double doors, leaving Jack all alone on the bench. People rushed up and down the hall, past the green-painted walls, past Jack, sitting on the lonely bench. He didn't know what he was going to do. He felt lost. He missed Kate. and at the same time hoped that she had vanished off the grid and that a killer hadn't found her as well. Sometime in the night, as he was sitting on the bench, mourning Uziel, lost in his own thoughts, Ehud arrived. He sat down on the bench beside Jack.
Any wold?
Jack stared at the floor.
He didn't make it. The doctor said there was nothing they could do.
Ehud nodded.
I'm really sorry, Jack.
It was planned out, you know? That suicide bomber was a distraction. Uziel had been the real target. At least no one was killed by that bomb. We're lucky it was defective.
It wasn't defective, Ehud said.
Jack frowned. What do you mean it wasn't defective? I saw the guy pushing the detonator over and over.
Ehud arched an eyebrow as he leaned in.
That wasn't the detonator he was pushing. It was the arming switch. He kept hitting the arming switch over and over, thinking it was the detonator. The bomb was live. If he would have instead hit the detonator, it would have gone off. He would have been a martyr.
Jack leaned back and folded his arms.
You've got to be kidding me.
Nope. The guy was probably panicked that he was about to die. Panicked that the bomb strapped around his body was about to blow him apart. In the confusion of that wild emotional state, he kept hitting the arming button instead of the detonator.
Do you really think so? That seems pretty odd. That kind usually want to die.
Yeah, but right at the last instant, it has to be traumatic. I imagine the human mind doesn't think clearly in that last moment when it knows it is about to die.
I suppose. What did the guy have to say for himself?
That's the weird part, Ehud said.
What's the weird part?
Ehud glanced up and down the hall, making sure no one was standing within earshot.
The weird part is that he doesn't speak Arabic, Farsi, or Hebrew, or any other Middle Eastern language or dialect.
Jack made a face.
What does he speak, then?
Spanish.
Jack leaned in a little more.
Spanish? He's from the ETA?
Ehud shook his head.
No, he's not part of the Basque separatist movement. He'd never heard of them.
Who then?
The only thing we could get out of him is that he's from Santiago de Querétaro in Mexico.
Mexico?
Jack looked up to make sure no one nearby had heard him.
He's from Mexico?
He asked in a lower voice.
That was about all we could get out of him. He's here from Santiago de Querétaro, in Mexico.
Jack heaved a sigh.
So he's a Mexican suicide bomber?
It appears so. Did you find out anything else?
Just that his name is Jose.
Jose.
Why was Jose from Santiago de Querétaro in Mexico trying to blow himself up all the way over here in Jerusalem?
Ehud shrugged.
All he would say was that he wanted to martyr himself for God. But I've got to tell you, Jack, the guy is dumb as a rock.
He tapped his temple.
I don't think he's all there.
It suddenly made sense. Terrorists often recruited the mentally handicapped and convinced them that it was the right thing to do, that it was the right thing to do for God. Jack rubbed his aching knees.
Do you think that maybe he was recruited because he's easily persuaded?
Possibly.
Jack sat back against the wall and folded his arms again.
A Mexican suicide bomber.
I don't get it.
I don't either,
Ehud admitted as he stood.
How about I give you a lift home?
Jack stood and went with Ehud.
A Mexican suicide bomber,
he muttered to himself as he walked down the hallway. 21. It was a warm day for autumn, so Angela was wearing the same low-rise cut-off shorts she intended to wear to her bartender job later. She had delivered a half-dozen courier drop-offs for lawyers and was about to head to Barry's place to work until they closed, when she got a call from Mike's mail service. Mike handled a variety of mail-related services for people, including collecting drop-offs for UPS and FedEx. When people occasionally brought him something that needed to be delivered locally by courier, he would call Angela. It wasn't often, but it all added up to make ends meet. When she walked into Mike's place, he was making out UPS shipping labels. "What's up?" she asked. Mike came to the counter.
"A courier came in from Syracuse. He's never been down here and doesn't know the area. He couldn't locate the address for his package. He said he's a small courier service and he's really outside his element down here. He needed to get back and asked me if I could have a local courier finish the delivery. He left some cash with the package."
Angela shrugged. "Sure, no problem." Mike pulled the box from under the counter. It was long and light. She thought it might be long-stemmed roses. When she saw the address, she immediately understood why the courier couldn't find the place. It was in the industrial area where most of the abandoned factories were located. The area was a maze of streets, alleys, vast concrete expanses, buildings, loading docks, and train tracks with sidings beside old factories, as well as fenced areas guarding corroded, outdated factory equipment and heavy machinery parts slowly rusting away. Many of the buildings had collapsed roofs, leaving only standing walls. Several of the buildings were still in good enough shape to be used for things like equipment storage. A few offered small office or business space. Those office areas were dingy and crude, but they were cheap, and used only occasionally by the people who stored equipment there long term. Even though a few of the buildings were occasionally still used, Angela had never seen anyone in the area. Because the old industrial tract was a labyrinth of derelict buildings, the addresses were confusing and, for the most part, missing. None of it was accurately located on any GPS. You just about had to be familiar with the abandoned area to find anything. The city didn't care to spend money maintaining what was, in essence, a ghost town. So street signs were rare. She suspected they were stolen for souvenirs or for decorations in teenagers' bedrooms. Her grandparents had often taken Angela with them on a Sunday drive. Usually, those rides went through the countryside, to be followed with getting an ice cream cone. But on occasion, her grandfather would take them through the old industrial area, pointing out factories he had helped build. More than once, Angela had listened to his stories of where a man had once died, hit by a girder swinging past him, and where another man had a heart attack and fell into freshly poured concrete footings, and where a fight had broken out over a dice game and one of the men had been stabbed to death.
"The guy left this as well," Mike said.
He laid 2 20s and a 10 on top of the long package.
"He said this should cover it for finishing the delivery. He was insistent that it was supposed to be delivered quickly. He said he was a small one-man service, and his income depended on his reputation remaining good. I told him I had the right courier."
Angela was much the same way. Her courier business was built on good word of mouth. She gave the 10 to Mike for handling the job. Paying him a commission kept him using her messenger service when he needed one.
"Thanks, Mike. Catch you the next time."
Once in her truck with the package, Angela pulled out an old map of Milford Falls that her grandfather had given her. She studied the map, trying to figure out where the address for Heartland Irrigation would be. She had a pretty good idea, and the map confirmed her initial thought. When she reached the old industrial area, rolling along among the abandoned factory buildings, she didn't see any people or cars. There weren't any new businesses in Milford Falls looking for factory space, so there was nothing keeping the industrial area from continuing its slow decay. She recognized one of the businesses she passed. The space was rented by an old guy who welded together pieces of junk steel he scavenged from the abandoned buildings. He created fanciful animals out of the junk and sold the pieces at art fairs. The building he was in was perfect for that sort of thing. Concrete, steel, and brick. Nothing to burn down with his torch, and no one to interrupt him as he worked. But he was getting old and in ill health, so he was rarely there anymore. Angela passed a building with rows of high windows divided up into small squares. Most of the glass had long ago been broken out. She recognized the place. When she had first encountered the man who killed the red-haired girl, she had seen that particular building in the vision she'd had. That was the first time she had recognized that a man was a killer by looking into his eyes. He was also the first man she had killed. She had sent that killer down the hellhole after she'd made him confess every detail of what he'd done in order to confirm her vision. As she drove past, she saw the cistern where that killer had put the body. It was sad to see such a place, and to know that the body of an innocent victim had surely rotted away down in the lonely, dark, wet hole long before Angela had encountered her killer. Angela drove on among the buildings, looking for Heartland Irrigation. She didn't see signs for it anywhere. That was hardly unusual. The place being so isolated and desolate was also probably why the sender didn't mail the package or send it by UPS, and instead sent it by courier. Many of the buildings were covered with graffiti. Taggers, like the rats, came out at night. It was a sketchy area. Fortunately, she always carried a gun in the center console of her truck. But the graffiti was old. There was no one to see their work, so the taggers had moved back to bridges, walls, and businesses in town. She at last spotted the address painted on a lonely, dented tan steel door. There were no windows, and there was no name to go with the address. There was an older, beige, four-door Toyota Camry parked by the door. Out of habit, when she delivered packages in rough areas, she committed the license plate number to memory. The black paint of the address did look somewhat fresh, compared to all the other peeling paint. She parked next to the Camry and hopped out of her truck. When she pounded on the metal door, she heard someone inside yell to come in. The door scraped on buckled concrete when she pulled it open. Inside was a small room without a ceiling or furniture, lit only by the high skylights and windows in the open area beyond. Long chains on geared rollers hung down to tilt the windows open at the top. No one was in the small room. Voices echoed from out back. Angela went through the opening in the front room, into the vast area of the old factory floor. Gray metal shelves stood to the right, sectioning off a smaller area from the open factory building beyond. To the left was another room. There were several stained folding tables in front of the shelves. Old, dirty blankets covered lumpy shapes on the tables. She noticed that items on the shelves were also covered in ratty old blankets or greasy moving pads. Other than a few small work lights clamped to the tables, most of the light came from the high windows on the far wall. Dilapidated wooden rolling chairs were pushed up to the tables with the lights. It was a dingy work area for whatever Heartland Irrigation did. Not far beyond the shelves, there were several types of milling machines and a pair of red gas-powered generators to run them and the minimal lighting. "Hello?" Angela called into the empty factory. "I have a delivery." Her voice echoed back from the darkness. A man in work overalls rushed out from the room to the left, wiping his hands with a filthy rag. Angela recognized him. Three other men followed him out of the room. She recognized all four men. They were the four Hispanic men she had waited on at the bar the night Owen had come in.
"A delivery. Yes. Thank you. Come in."
one of them said in a heavy accent. He gestured with a hand, inviting her in closer. As the other three came forward, she got a good look at their eyes for the first time. It had been dark in the bar, and the rotating ceiling light made it difficult to see anyone's eyes unless they were close, the way Owen had been. After Angela learned that she could recognize killers by looking at their eyes, she came to learn to recognize a range of threat in the eyes of people who hadn't yet committed murder. Frankie's eyes had been like that. Not a killer's, but something close. Bosca's eyes had been even worse. They were the eyes of someone extremely dangerous, someone with a violent temper, someone who would hurt you, even though he had not yet killed anyone. Both Frankie and Bosca had the eyes of men who could at some point easily cross that line into murder. The eyes of these four men were like that. Cunning. Calculating. Cruel. Bosca had a certain cast to his eyes when he wanted her, a look of focused lust, a look of commitment to getting what he wanted. It was a look that made the hair on the back of her neck stand on end and paralyzed her with fear. These four men had that look in their eyes. Moleface moved off behind her and into the front room. She heard the deadbolt on the front door click home. Angela was a rabbit in the center of a pack of rabid dogs. 22. The man with the rag finished wiping his hands and tossed it on a table.
"You have something for us, no? Something for Heartland Irrigation?"
"That's right," Angela said, trying to sound official. She wanted to give them the package and be gone. He put his fingers to his chest.
"I am Emilio. Here, come, put your package on the table."
He held his hand out toward the table beside him. Angela couldn't imagine anyone sending long-stemmed roses to these men, so she knew the package had to contain something else. At the moment, that was the least of her concerns. She tossed the long package on the table. "There you go." She backed away. "Thank you."
"No, no," Emilio said, waving a hand back and forth. "Wait for us to see if everything is...
He turned to one of the other two.
"¿Qué es la palabra?"
"No damaged," one of them said.
"Yes, that is the words."
Emilio turned back to her with a smile.
"No damaged. We will see first if the things inside is no damaged."
"I'm running late," Angela said as she continued backing away. She gestured to the package. "There is no damage to the outside of the box. I'm not responsible for what's inside or how it was packed. If there is any damage inside, you will have to notify the shipper."
"The shipper,"
Emilio said, looking at the others briefly. His gaze returned to glide down her bare legs. When his eyes turned up, he gave her a sly smile.
"But they are very, very far away. So let us first see that there is no damage inside."
She could sense Moleface up close behind her, making sure that she didn't try to leave. She could smell him, a combination of some chemical smell and stale body odor. She didn't let herself turn to look at him. She wanted to break and run for the door, but she knew that he was waiting for her to try that. She also knew that he had locked the door, so it would take her precious seconds to unlatch the deadbolt. Emilio pulled a big combat knife from a sheath under his waistband and slowly ran the blade down the length of the box. He returned the knife to its sheath and lifted the flaps of the box to look inside. He pulled out a folded piece of paper along with a long plastic tube, hardly thicker than his thumb. Inside the tube was what looked to be a long, folded, very thin wire with a red cap at one end. After inspecting it, he put it back in the box with the others, and then set the box on the table. He then unfolded a piece of paper and read it in silence, his smile widening as he reached the end. He showed it to the men to either side, pointing out something.
Miguel,
I think you shall see this, he said to Moleface, standing behind her. These are orders from Rafael.
Emilio stepped forward to give Miguel the paper. It gave him the chance to move in close in front of her, closer than she liked. She was sandwiched between the two men. Angela glanced around, looking for another way out. The front door wasn't a good option because it was locked with a deadbolt. She didn't like the odds of four against one, and decided that if it came down to it, her best option would be to make a break for the empty factory floor. She was sure that out in the open she could run faster than these men, giving her time to try to find another way out. She was acutely aware that her gun was out in the truck. A gun would even the odds, but carrying a concealed weapon was illegal, so she always had to leave it in her truck. A lot of good it did her there. With the door bolted and these four close to her, there was not going to be any way for her to get to the gun if she ended up needing it. A sickening sense of dread washed through her. Her knees felt weak. A voice in her head screamed for her to break and run, but she knew that predators were driven to chase prey when it ran. If she ran and didn't find a way out, she would be trapped. Still, against four men, running was her best option. With no time to waste, Angela suddenly bolted for the space between the men. She elbowed one of them aside as she made a mad dash toward the opening between the standing shelves. Moleface yelled to the others,
"Agarrala! Agarrala!"
Everything seemed to move in slow motion, her legs feeling as if they were mired in molasses. As Angela knocked one man aside, two of the other men blocked her escape route. They each seized an arm before she could go for her knife as a third man, the one she had elbowed out of the way, swept an arm in around her waist from behind. With three men holding her, there was no way for her to run or fight. She tried, but couldn't break their hold on her arms. The man with his arm around her waist snatched her hair in his other fist. Panting, in fury, she tried to twist out of his grip around her, but he was too strong. She kicked at them, trying to get them to let go. They danced around with her, avoiding her heels as she kicked. She squirmed and fought as they all tightened their grips on her, controlling her arms. As Miguel put his hands around her throat, she tried to use her head to smash his face, but the one holding her hair pulled her head back, preventing her from striking. When one of them adjusted his grip on her arms, she landed a kick in the kidneys of the man to the other side. He immediately punched her in the gut to take some of the fight out of her. It worked. Besides struggling to get away, she now had to struggle to get her breath. Angela didn't know if they had a plan to begin with, but when they saw her, recognized her from the bar, and realized she was alone and vulnerable, they saw their opportunity to take something they all wanted.
"Hold her tight!"
Miguel shouted as he went to a shelf and pulled down a grease-covered moving pad. He threw it on the floor. He came up in front of her and put his face close to hers. He grinned.
"I felt your leg before. Remember? In the bar? I liked what I felt. I told my friends how good it felt. Now, I am going to feel much more."
Angela's fear at what these men were going to do to her made her struggle frantically to get away. She tried with all her strength to break their hold on her arms. Not having the use of her arms only increased her sense of helplessness. She tried to kick Miguel. The men to each side locked a leg around one of hers, preventing her from kicking. Miguel slapped her hard across the face. The three men holding her had her completely locked down and unable to fight back. Miguel sneered as he hit her again, as if out of some deep-seated contempt. He leaned in to whisper in her ear,
"You are all the same. American women think they should have a say, but in the eyes of God, you are all Satan's whores. Women are dirt in his eyes, and the eyes of all devout men."
Angela wasn't sure what he was talking about, but it fit her first impression of these men when she had seen them in the bar. By the look in their eyes now, she could see that they all shared some sort of fundamental disapproval of her, of her way of life. They were all somehow viscerally offended by her, and yet they were also sexually aroused by her. Miguel unbuttoned her shorts, and then slowly unzipped them. He sank down before her, pulling her shorts and panties down her legs as he went.